Film Spotting is presented by Spout.com. The best movies not coming to theaters and the top 5 music videos of the year have been decided. Check them out at blog.spout.com.
Well done, Adam.
Thank you.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. This week on the show, we'll round out the year in film by rounding up some of our usual Film Spotting suspects. Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune and Scott Tobias from the AV Club will stop by and help us count down our top 10 films of 2008.
Can't wait for that. Plus, Massacre Theater and music by David Ford. But first, quick reviews of three big holiday releases. Clint Eastwood's Gran Torino, 7 Pounds with Will Smith, and we go mano a mano with Tricky Dick himself in Frost Nixon.
Good evening. I shall resign the presidency at noon tomorrow.
This is an historic day, the only time a president has ever resigned from office.
Nixon knew about the Watergate cover-up.
The man who has committed the greatest felony in American history will never stand trial.
I've had an idea for an interview, Richard Nixon.
You're a talk show host.
I spent yesterday watching you interview the Bee Gees.
Weren't they terrific?
Why would I want to talk to David Frost?
I got $500,000.
Maddie, as I finally got a chance to catch up with Frost Nixon, one of our most anticipated movies of this holiday season, I couldn't shake two other movies while I was watching it. I think the film's a lot like A Few Good Men, in that you know the whole thing is building up to a showdown between a lightweight investigator and his heavyweight adversary, a guy with some real gravitas. Of course, Jack Nicholson in that film. Here you have Frank Langella playing Richard Nixon. And it's the lightweight's job to get the other to admit to something they both know he can't say. David Frost thinks the American people are entitled to the truth about Watergate. And the big dramatic question here in Frost Nixon isn't just whether Richard Nixon thinks the American people can handle it, but whether he himself can handle saying it. I also thought of our review from last week. We talked about the film Doubt from John Patrick Shanley. The roles are reversed a little bit, though. It's the heavyweight, Meryl Streep's Sister Aloysius, confronting the more naive Father Flynn. We both like that movie, but one of your criticisms was that the final showdown needed a better choreographer, that showdown between Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman. I want to know if Ron Howard here in Frost Nixon, who is also adapting a popular stage play to the screen, it should be pointed out, does he do a better job than John Patrick Shanley in giving you that big final confrontation?
Yes, that's the one part he really gets right.
You're right.
The layout of this film is pretty easy. It follows the arc of, say, When We Were Kings, the great documentary about the Ali Foreman-Kinshasa fight. The first part of the film, you hit it, is spent getting to know these pugilists and their stakes mm-hmm. in the game. For Tricky Dick, he's seeking absolution, he's seeking money, maybe a way back into the political game. And then for David Frost, he's seeking fame. And then, of course, he's the guy that's going to have to transform, you know, what he wants throughout the course of the film. For me, yes, the fight held up. It was delicious fun, especially watching Langella. Unfortunately, the first part of the film was really muddy waters mm-hmm. for me, which is odd for a Ron Howard film.
Yeah.
If nothing else, and
I'm
a big Ron Howard fan. You're exactly. You can count on his characters living so vividly within that frame. Stylistically here, he is uncharacteristically all over the place. He tries to employ this pseudo-documentary style, which just comes across as really, really awkward, and even a handy cam shot or two, which just don't work. For a director normally so gifted at introducing and fleshing out characters, big and small, he really drops the ball here. And think back, Adam, to Apollo 13, one of my favorite films. Who are the most compelling characters in that movie? The NASA nerds working the control room. Here he has the same opportunity to let those characters, those secondary characters, shine, the Nixon and Frost teams, their respective teams, and none of their storylines add up to anything.
No, they really don't. We were excited to see guys like Sam Rockwell in this film and even Oliver Platt, and really, they are completely wasted in this movie. And we didn't see this movie together, but we could have because we have the exact same notes. The payoff in the end is there. Mm-hmm. It does work. It does make it all worthwhile for me. I can recommend it. I can say I liked it. But I do have to say that this movie was a disappointment for me because of the high expectations I went in with. I was really hoping this movie would be great, would be one of my favorite films of the year, just because I love the subject matter so much. I'm just kind of a political buff like you are. Mm-hmm. Watergate, you know, I love All the President's Men. So it's just a great story that I was really interested in learning more about. Obviously, it's about television, too, and about entertainers. And I wanted to see that, and also about journalism. So all those things rolled into this big piece here in Frost Nixon. I was really looking forward to it. But you're so right that the opening stuff, the first 30 minutes, really everything leading up to the final showdown, it's a really bad use of the documentary style. And I don't really know what
lifeless.
Ron Howard was
absolutely
going for.
Absolutely lifeless.
I mean, it didn't feel like a documentary at any point. All of the conversations, I shouldn't say conversations, all of the talking heads where someone like Sam Rockwell, supposedly a little bit older, is reflecting back on this event. He plays James Reston. You know, they all felt scripted. They were all obviously scripted, just saying scripted lines as opposed to it being an interview, which is what it was supposed to be. And even worse, these dialogue scenes were mostly redundant. They mm-hmm. always ruin the flow of just giving us the story. You didn't need it. You could have filled in those blanks without that device. Ron Howard could have done a better job of that. And every time one of those talking heads came on screen telling me something I already knew or knew I could figure out for myself, I just got angry with the film, actually.
Yeah, and poor Michael Sheen, who was remarkable in The Queen as Tony Blair, yeah. seems to have gotten the wince and pause direction from Ron Howard one too many times.
Maybe.
I can imagine it on the set. Okay. Okay, Michael, someone just impugned your credibility. Why don't you, I know what you should do. You should pause and consider that. Okay, now I want you to consider that just a little bit longer. Now, how about, great. Now look out over the horizon. Now, how about a wince?
Right.
There we go.
A lot of wincing.
And cut. Yeah, it's just, Langella is terrific, though.
He
is great. And there's always that initial hurdle to get over when someone is playing Nixon because the man's mannerisms, Nixon himself, were so big. So, mm-hmm. you know, when you adopt them, it looks like so-and-so doing Nixon. It's all jowls and hunchback. But as the movie progresses, he becomes the character the movie needs. Doesn't become Richard Nixon.
That's
true.
He
becomes the Nixon that this film needs. And then there is that payoff in the interview. When they're finally sparring, that's all I needed.
Yeah, I agree with you. And unfortunately, it does kind of leave them out to dry leading up to that point. But it did bring me back in, as it did you. I agree with you about Michael Sheen, though, a little bit. I was really hoping to see also a great performance from him. I loved him in The Queen as well. But unfortunately, he does come off as too much like a haircut in a suit,
mm-hmm.
which I know is kind of what he's supposed to be playing, this entertainer in David Frost and not the journalist. But I actually think Ron Howard is the one who sets him up with not enough intellectual curiosity. He really does come off as someone who is too unprepared. We never see him prepare for the interview until he has to. I have a hard time believing that was really the case, that
right.
he really just showed up on set and was winging it, you know, going from his notes. I don't buy that for a second. And then because it paints him as so unprepared, when we finally get the big confrontation, the payoff isn't quite as big as it even could be because we've never seen him really prepare like he should for the moment. It's just a little too much of a kind of Cinderella underdog story in the end for me to really get behind. So unfortunately, one I do recommend, one I do like, but wasn't the great film I was hoping for this holiday season.
So what are we going to do for dinner?
Well, that seaweed house they just went to sounded good.
But how are we going to get there? You're not supposed to drive anymore.
We'll see who can't drive their grandson at night without glasses or a license using a mop to press the pedals. Let's go!
That was Cotton Hill from Mike Judge's King of the Hill, who tragically lost his knees in Korea and doesn't mind telling you about it. I think Cotton was narrowly beaten out for the role of Walt Kowalski by Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino. Of course, it helps that Mr. Eastwood also directed this film. Walt Kowalski is a retired Ford auto plant worker. He's recently lost his wife, and his neighborhood is undergoing a bit of a demographic change. Walt finds himself living amongst an immigrant Hmong community. Adam, I can hear Clint Eastwood say, "Get off my lawn," in the trailer for this film, really growl that line.
Yeah.
And I can derive minutes of pleasure reciting it over and over to myself and anyone that may cross my path, as I have been doing the past 2 weeks. Is there any reason I need to see the whole film?
Well, I don't want to derail us here and get to your take on the movie first, but are you enjoying it because you derive some unintentional comedy pleasure out of it, or do you genuinely enjoy watching him say that line?
I genuinely enjoyed Clint Eastwood's performance in this film.
Okay, well, I did too, and I would say yes in answer to your question, because I think the movie is filled with Clint Eastwood delivering great lines like that, and I do mean delivering great lines. It's not that the line lines themselves are so amazing.
Oh, no.
But the way he does it is what makes the film work. I actually think that Eastwood's performance is one of the best of the year.
Easily.
He made my Chicago Film Critics ballot in my top five, ahead, believe it or not, of Frank Langella, even though I really did like him as well.
Dad, you worked hard your whole life. Maybe it's time you started thinking about taking it easier. These places are nothing like what you'd think they'd be. They're great.
Kicking us out on his birthday. I told you this was a bad idea.
What the hell these Chinese have to move in this neighborhood for?
Dorothy mentioned specifically that it was her desire for you to go to confession.
And I confess that I have no desire to confess to a boy that's just out of the seminary.
But it's not just a one-note performance by any means, as it could be with lines like that and other lines I'm sure you heard there in the trailer. You do get this grizzled kind of Eastwood badass character, but there's also humor in this performance. There is emotion in this performance, and even those grizzled lines are not just these glib kind of dirty, hairy throwaways. There is experience behind everything Walt says, and if this is his swan song, as some have suggested or some are suggesting that Eastwood has said this might be his last performance, you know what? It's not maybe the greatest film he could go out with, though I did like it on the whole, but if he goes out on this performance, that'd be fine with me.
This is the final installment, I think, in the Dirty Harry saga.
Maybe, yeah.
This is Dirty Harry meets Grumpy Old Man. And at one point in this film, Walt Kowalski's family threatens to move him out of his house where he's lived forever. Walt snarls at them and kicks them out of the house. I think Eastwood is telling the film industry, look, I'm not going quietly into the night. You needed me on that wall. I am still on that
few
wall.
Few good men, another reference.
And unfortunately, I think the film is this perfect storm of mediocrity. It is awful dialogue. Unfortunately, the actors playing the Hmong kids living next door cannot act.
They can't.
And then you've got Eastwood directing with all the subtlety of a sledgehammer upside your head.
Yeah.
But even after all that, like I said, I really enjoyed watching Clint. I was able to put blinders on to everything else swirling around him and enjoy Dirty Harry solve his last case.
Well, before I take down the same people you just took down, I do want to say that without spoiling anything, the story here is one we've seen before. You are expecting these characters to all come together and sing Kumbaya. You know where it's going, but Eastwood and the screenwriter Nick Schenck do manage to play with our expectations a little bit in the way some of the relationships end up playing out, and in a crucial moment with Walt that you know from about the 10-minute point into the film is going to come at the end of the film. You know it's coming. You know a certain scene is going to take place. Again, I'm not going to say anything more, but the way it's handled by Eastwood and the screenwriter is really surprising and effective.
Yes.
There are some good moments here.
It is classic Aristotelian structure.
There it is again.
It really is. Unfortunately, the dialogue employed in many of the scenes, although they move the plot forward, are so over the top and cringeworthy. And I'm thinking about that scene with the great John Carroll Lynch as the barber and Clint Eastwood and they're bringing the young kid. Oh, it just didn't, it was so over the top.
Well, that's what keeps this movie from being a really good or great film, is that there always seems to be some early scenes in Eastwood movies that just feel awkward. I'm thinking of At the Church, the opening scene of this film where his wife, Walt's wife, has passed away and the kids are coming and the kids are talking about Walt and they give us so much exposition, and unfortunately that's exactly what it feels like. That is what they're doing. They're just there to feed us information. Doesn't feel natural at all, and that is the writing and the directing. And as you said, the performance of the Hmong actors, they are first-time actors, and unfortunately it felt like it.
Yeah.
They just aren't very good here. They're not acting on the same level that Clint is or some of the other people in the film. And I will say, too, that the climax felt a little too tidy and is absolutely ridiculous. And of course, too, it's just a very simple movie. The bad guys here are really bad. You have a guy like Walt who is pretty complex, and we see him go through some changes, but you know, there are some characters like the gang that they have to deal with that it's almost laughable in the way they're characterized. And we don't see anything about where they came from or why they are the way they are, why they want so badly for their nephew or whatever, to their cousin, to join this gang. It doesn't really work. It's all a little too tidy.
No, I honestly only recommend this if you love watching Clint Eastwood in his element. It's worth it for that. But as a film, it really, really falls short.
All right. Well, why don't we close out this segment, Maddie, with just a minute or two on the new Will Smith vehicle, 7 Pounds.
In 7 days, God created the world. And in 7 seconds, I shattered mine.
You are my family, and I really want to help you. But I am looking at you, and it's like you're not even here.
When you sign your name, you'll own my house. I only ask that you never try to contact me for any reason.
Maddie, I have heard a little bit of buzz about this film, and whenever people talk about it, they say, it's interesting because we don't know anything about Will Smith from the trailer. You don't know anything about his character.
What's the
you don't
secret?
Know. Yeah, what's the secret? Who is this guy? What has he suffered through or why he is suffering? And of course, you know that he wants to help people. He has some plan to help people, but you don't know exactly what it is. And those mysteries here are really at the core of this movie. Now, I want to say we don't get to see a lot of movies together, but we do occasionally. We saw this one. And near the end of this movie, in a big emotional moment, I happened to hear you make a sound. I'm going to say this on air. You made some kind of sound, and I didn't know whether that sound was a snicker, whether you thought something was a little bit laughable, a little bit hokey, or if you were genuinely moved by it, because this film does pull at the heartstrings a little bit. So, Maddie, reveal to me, reveal to our listeners, come clean. What was it?
I don't know if you know this, but Uncle Maddie likes to play the ponies, and in the Sport of Kings, we've got names for different kinds of horses. Rabbits are sprinters that jump out to an early lead. They're entered into the race just, you know, for the sole purpose of the pack chasing them. This film is not a rabbit. And at first I thought I came up with the best term for a long while. It was going to be glue. But then,
wow,
it actually became a closer. Because, yes, for the better part of the film, this thing just laid there on the screen. Hmm. It laid there, I think it laid there on the page. The screenplay was something akin to the Twilight Zone crossed with a Hallmark greeting card. But by the end, spurred by Rosario Dawson's performance, it started to pick up because the film finally got out of its own way and decided, you know what? It's not about the mystery. It's not about the secret. It's not about all this exposition. And it just let the relationship between Dawson and Smith take over, which was enjoyable enough for the final 20 minutes of the film. The rest of the film, I could really leave.
Well, it sounds like we had a similar experience in terms of our sum total of our experience, in terms of how we came out with this film. But I disagree with you a little bit. I actually did enjoy the first part much more.
Oh,
I thought there was, I mean, it's not a huge mystery. It's not like there really is much of a secret here. They give you lots of clues and you know where it's going, but it's compelling
then
enough.
Then why do they keep drawing that out?
I don't know. It was compelling enough for me, though. There was tension there in trying to figure out exactly what this guy has planned. As long as you're waiting to see that plan unfold, I was kind of hooked by this film. And then I did really love some of those moments with Will Smith and Rosario Dawson. He's as good as you expect him to be. She actually, I said to you afterwards, if we had to go back and revise our top five supporting actresses of the year, I might put her on.
Oh, she's
I
very,
think she's
very
that
good.
Really startling here in her performance. And some of the moments they have of this relationship, those moments of first love, really they pull off completely. But actually, as it becomes a little bit more of a conventional love story, for me, somehow the tension started to evaporate a little bit. Something that cord that was making everything kind of just sit on an edge a little bit and make his character sit on an edge a little bit kind of went away. And I started to lose interest. Even as I was learning more about these people that I did like a lot, I got less interested in it. So I think it actually started out a little bit better.
No, you and I have completely, we ended at the same spot. We got there different ways. I actually didn't buy Will Smith. Look, Will Smith is one of the few people I would buy Amway from. He is really that charming. And we're supposed to believe that this character holds some kind of debilitating or dramatic secret. I didn't feel that tension at all because I didn't buy it in his persona. He's actually supposed to be, you're supposed to be rather suspicious of why he's doing this, why he's being mean to people.
Yeah.
I didn't get it. It looked like Will Smith trying to be mean. I didn't buy it for a second.
Okay. Well, 7 Pounds is out now in theaters everywhere. You can see for yourself whether it's better at the beginning or better at the end. Gran Torino and Frost Nixon are only playing in select cities. If you see any of these films and agree or disagree with our takes, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater, and it's time to pop in some Europe into that tape deck because we're about to begin the final countdown.
Got it in my car.
We kick off our top 10 films of 2008 next.
Pity little price to pay to make the hard times go away, but I love you as you are. I say the words and then I'm not so sure exactly what we say them for, and this is my concern. But everybody needs a place to start. Oh wait, let's be your heavy heart and lean your thoughts on me. And ain't it hard? precious working teams to leave you where you are. You decimate my inhibitions, and I can't be sane. Let's take a walk out on the broken glass. Come on, come on, come on.
Don't be smart now. You go right back and put that back until you finish your dinner. All right, I'm warning you. You take one bite out of that, you're in big trouble. Don't you dare. Don't you dare do that. Did you hear me? Hey, stop. Hold it right there. You put that ice cream in your mouth, and you are in very, very, very big trouble. Don't you dare go anywhere beyond that. Put it down right now. I am not going to say it again. I am not going to say it again.
Welcome back to Film Spotting alongside Adam Kempinar. I'm Matty Robinson. It is time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I perform a scene from a beloved screenplay and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning the beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week we massacred the scene you just heard between Dustin Hoffman and Justin Henry from Kramer versus Kramer, a tie-in with our review of Doubt and Best Supporting Performances of the Year. Both films, of course, starred Meryl Streep.
Yes.
Streep's performance won her an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress and also featured performances from Jane Alexander and Justin Henry, the youngest nominee in the history of the Academy Awards. I would have to say, regretfully so.
Maybe so, but only one listener, Maddie, got the other clever connection that we mentioned, the one you came up with. We were hoping more might get it, but we got to give credit to Leah from, sadly, Parts Unknown. She writes, the Meryl Streep connection, obviously, but really, how about the Hoffman, Philip and Dustin, good thinking.
Yeah, and unfortunately, she's from Parts Unknown. Otherwise, I'd send her a Film Spotting mug.
Oh, that's right. If only we knew where she was from.
All right. Well, why don't you reach in to that Film Spotting hat and pull out this week's winner.
And the winner is, oh, Maddie, you may know this guy. Mm. Everyone knows each other in Minnesota, right? Jay Walter is from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Very nice.
Congratulations, Jay. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
I've worked with a lot of directors, Lloyd. Some of them were geniuses, some of them were bastards, but I've never met one who was so totally and absolutely, I don't know.
Thank you, Gary. I'm very touched. Now, will you get up stage?
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, one in which I'm predicting we will get the most entries ever. I'm throwing down that challenge, Maddie. I think I'm going to start it off, so you're going to give me the action.
And anybody could direct this scene. Action.
Yeah, you just take Soupy Sales to prom. I can think of so many cooler things to do that night. Like, you know what? I might pumice my feet. I might go to a Unitarian church, maybe get hit by a truck full of hot garbage juice, you know? Because all those things would be exponentially cooler than going to prom with you.
You're being really immature. You have no reason to be mad at me. I mean, you know, you broke my heart. I should be royally ticked off at you. I should be really cheesed off. I shouldn't want to talk to you anymore.
What? Because I got bored and had sex with you and I didn't want to, like, marry you? And scene. All right, nicely done, Maddie. If you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net. You have until New Year's Day, January 1st, to submit your entry.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on our next all-new show in January. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit filmspotting.net.
The only sort of big movie that I've seen that's in the hunt right now is Benjamin Button, mm-hmm. which I really liked. But I know Fincher, so
yeah.
I did the Q&A with him after a screening in New
really?
York. So I was predisposed.
Yeah,
but I still liked it because I felt for David, it was a terrific lateral move. It's a beautifully made movie, and it's very emotional. And Zodiac was one of my favorite movies of last year. And I really feel like he's expanding his horizons. Like his idea of what he can do is expanding. And mm-hmm. I think that's really exciting because he's so talented.
The voice you heard there, director Steven Soderbergh. The question was, what's the best film you've seen so far this year? Obviously, he said The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, the David Fincher film, and Steven Soderbergh will be a guest here on Film Spotting, Maddie, next month. I know you can't wait.
And it has to be said, Steven Soderbergh and David Fincher are pretty much
as
best
he noted.
Buds.
Yeah, they're pretty tight. He noted the bias there, but again, you can look forward to that interview when we discuss the film Che. January 16th, I think. So we will discuss that film and play my full conversation with him when that movie does open.
I heard a rumor that Steven Soderbergh hates Danny Boyle.
Really?
I'm going to start that right here.
You're going to start
right here and right now.
Why? Because they're competing over Slumdog Millionaire?
For the number one slot on our top 10 of the year.
Yeah, that's true. Slumdog Millionaire is getting a lot of love. We'll see if it made our list here as we do finally get into our top 10 movies of 2008. We're going to bring our special guests on for the top five here in a moment. But first, we're just going to dive in, Maddie, to our 10 through 6. I really can't wait to hear what movies stood out for you this year. And I just want to mention that I do ask myself some questions. I've said this before here on the show, when I'm trying to parse through this list and figure out which movies make that final cut, I ask myself a couple things. Do you ask yourself anything?
Do you put together a grand list of all the films that qualify?
I don't, actually. It's much easier for me to just think of the 10 to 20 obvious films that stood out from the pack this year and then try and rank them. That's all I do. I don't do a master list at all.
Well, as always, my research is so much more extensive than yours. My professionalism, as always, comes through more than yours.
Yes.
The Matty Robinson 2008 Film Spotting Best Films of the Year Committee, we agonized over 154 films. I had some interns throw a spreadsheet together. I have seen 154 films that qualify, and to qualify, they had to have made the BoxOfficeMojo.com release schedule for the year. It's
okay.
Not the most scientific in the
no.
world, but ultimately I had to narrow 154 down to 10.
Okay, let's hear it.
My number 10, Zach and Miri Make a Porno.
Really?
I know. My affinity for this film is disproportionate to that of most of America's, but I think we are truly watching the evolution of a great filmmaker in Kevin Smith. I love this film structure, and I absolutely adore his use of language here. The very unique libretto that he gives his characters. I think that's what separates this film from other romantic comedies. Yes, the final act left me wanting a little bit, but that was saved by a monologue from actor Jason Mewes. Unfortunately, I cannot play that on public radio.
Though you are pantsless right now.
One of my favorite bits of dialogue all year. Overall, a great, great film.
I'm really happy to see a comedy make the top 10 here. Maybe we'll see a few more.
And it just beat out Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which is my number 11.
Okay. Well, I mentioned that I have some questions that I like to ask myself as I try to figure out these movies. And I was actually talking today with a buddy of ours, Sam Smith, who is a great film mind, has a very keen sense, likes a lot
also
of movies.
Also not a bad drummer.
Not a bad drummer, actually. A very fine musician. Plays with Ben Folds, actually. And we were chatting about movies today and how we were forming our list. He's going through and making his list. And he came up with two questions that I do ask myself a lot when I'm doing this. And he said, first of all, if you had 2 hours to kill, which movie would you watch first? That's a good, helpful question. And then the other one is, which one would you urge someone else to see first if you had to pick between two movies? Those are helpful, but I have to say this year I added a new wrinkle when trying to come up with the 10. The overarching question for me was, here's the scenario. Every movie from 2008 is going to be destroyed. I don't know, some vicious aliens. I don't know, but someone comes down and says, you know what? Every film's got to be destroyed, except Adam, you get to pick the 10 that survive.
Wow, not most amount of nude scenes.
That's for you how you would do it?
That's how you and I differ.
Yeah, exactly. So I asked myself that question, and that's how I did come up with at least my initial list of 10 movies here. And my number 10 film I am going with, The Dark Knight. Is it perfect? No, it's absolutely not. But it would be a shame if future generations missed out on seeing Heath Ledger as the Joker. We had a lot of praise for him last week on the show. And also, if they missed out on seeing how Christopher Nolan and his brother Jonathan, his co-screenwriter, how they, I think, elevated the comic book genre to something more than just mass entertainment. Those elements are still there. It's still a very entertaining, fun summer movie. But the choices those characters have to make and the forces they're battling are reflective, I think, of the uneasy world we live in. And it was actually worthy of two shows worth of discussion here on Film Spotting, and not just because of the film's popularity, but there was really enough to chew on there. And I look forward to chewing on it some more as I see that movie again. So The Dark Knight did make my list at number 10.
Not a bad film at all. All right, well, my number 9 is Man on Wire. It is, I think, a wonderful documentary and one of the best thrillers we've seen all this year. And we did a heist marathon this year. This tells the story of Philippe Petit's daring tightrope walk between the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in 1974. And I have to say, much to the filmmaker's, Jane Marsh's, credit, the film never mentions the toppling of the Twin Towers in 2001, and instead focuses on the pure thrill. And it really is thrilling. Mm-hmm. We know how it ends, but you are on the edge of your seat, and the beauty, the absolute beauty of that achievement.
Yeah, and at this point, it's almost unanimously taking the Best Documentary Award among all the various film critics groups, and very much deservedly so. My number nine, Maddie, is a movie that has continued to divide critics after its release, months after its release. I'm going to quote here Jürgen Fouth from About.com, writing under the headline, Most Disappointing Movies of 2008. We're going to play a little game here, Maddie. This is what Jürgen had to say. This year's movie to beat in terms of bloated, overarching ambition and joyless, suffocating self-seriousness. If you don't like it, you just don't understand. I found out the hard way that it's also a terrible cocktail party topic, guaranteed to divide and infuriate even the most convivial gathering. So, Maddie, here we go. Jürgen says, avoid at all costs this movie, bloated, overarching ambition, joyless, suffocating self-seriousness. The movie is...
Well, you already said The Dark Knight.
Yes, I did.
Okay, I'm going to go with Milk.
Let's try Synecdoche, New York.
Oh, jeez.
I've talked to you before. It's not a play about dating. It's about death. Make it personal. Move along.
He was an ideologist. It is a play about dating. It's not a play just about death. It's about everything. Dating, birth, death, life, family, all that.
Adam, I have very few rules in my life. Number one, never trust anyone named Jürgen.
That's it,
You do not want them on your pit crew.
Well, that works for me. And of course, Jürgen's taking a shot at us here, Maddie, totally indirectly. But we ripped two other critics here on the show for just flinging up their hands and saying, I don't get this movie. Here's the thing, though, about Synecdoche, New York. I'm not going to sit here and claim to understand it and what is happening scene to scene any more than anyone else, but it's also not nearly as unintelligible as some would have you believe.
No.
A character actually says the point of the movie in the film. It's about realizing that we're all leads in our own story. I mean, that's as good of a nutshell summation of what this film's about, and it's actually pretty familiar ground. If anyone wants to grab some Pirandello the next time they're hopping on the subway or taking a flight somewhere, it's been covered before.
Yeah.
And in the end, the only thing to get is seeing something sublime in these desperate characters and their longing, in their search for answers and their search for meaning, no matter how futile it is. And I did get that, even if others did not. And that's fine if they didn't, but I did. And I'm never going to fault a filmmaker for overarching ambition. And the film is challenging, but you know what? Kaufman has such a great sense of humor that we've seen in his other films as a writer that there's no way I would call this movie joyless. Suffocating at times, sure.
Right.
But joyless, no, it's my number nine.
Well, I'll give Jürgen some credit. Yes, perhaps it is a bit bloated. That's fine. At least he pondered what the movie was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And look, this program is always going to come down on the side of those films. We did a Bergman marathon, for Pete's sake. We are always going to try and come down on the side of those films that make you think, good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, my number eight is The Wrestler. We have not talked about this film, so I am not going to expound too much. In fact, I'm not going to expound at all, other than to say that Mickey Rourke's performance puts this film on my top 10.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick Cage is worthy of my admiration because he stepped away from this project. He was attached to it. It was his project, knowing director Darren Aronofsky wanted Mickey Rourke. And for that, Nick Cage, you get a little tip of my hat.
Nice pick there. My number eight, Maddie, is the film My Winnipeg from director Guy Madden. This is a Film Spotting Golden Brick Award winner, if we're calling it that. It's one of those small movies we've championed here on the show and tried to get the word out on and have had many listeners write in and say, yep, you know what, I saw it and you were right. It's really great. And we, of course, talked to Madden back at the Toronto Film Festival in 07. I do encourage anyone to go to the interviews page at filmspotting.net if you want to hear that conversation. But any movie that is its own genre, that basically creates its own genre, here you have the docu-fantasia, that has to be kept around for future generations, and especially a film in which the director hires actors to play his family and reshoot scenes from his life in the house he grew up in, hoping to glean some insight from that into what he is, what he's all about, what his attachment to his hometown's all about. It's hilarious, and it's touching at the same time, and totally absurd. I had a lot of fun with My Winnipeg.
Now, wouldn't you give At the Movies, the two Bens, a lot more credit if they had said, hey, skip Synecdoche, New York. This actual material is better handled in a film
it
like My Winnipeg.
Yeah, it kind of is.
That's all we're looking for,
that's
folks.
It.
Just some intellectual curiosity.
That's it.
All right, well, my number seven, Paranoid Park.
Hmm.
My favorite Gus Van Sant flick this year. For me, it really did serve as this hypnotic, mesmerizing, kind of almost gonzo look at a high schooler's life. But what kept it from being just a really pretty, trippy painting on the wall was the murder plot tucked throughout the film. That parable of life and death fit right in because really, what is high school to high schoolers but obviously, life and death.
Yeah, absolutely. A great pick there. My number seven is a movie I know we both liked, and that is the new film from Jonathan Demme, Rachel Getting Married. Why don't we go ahead and hear a scene from it?
Why is Emma the maid of honor? Why am I not the maid of honor? Because. What does that mean? Because I wasn't entirely sure when you were coming or if you'd even make it. It's a sari. You take a bolt of cloth and you wrap it around yourself a bunch of times.
I've been home for a day. I can't get a straight answer to this.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about Dad offering me food every 2 seconds.
Oh, you know what? Dad offers Irish hunger strikers food.
No, it's not even about the food. He has to know exactly where I am at all times because he's never resolved his own trust issues.
That's odd.
You know what? Shut the heck.
I think this film is just in a lot of ways a wonder, a true wonder, because it's about a dysfunctional family with characters who are just cranked up to 11 almost the entire film. People I would normally want to stay away from as much as I could, and yet I could have spent more time with these people because the range of emotions on display here and the humanity is just amazing. The rehearsal toast scene that I know some people think goes on too long, I think it's pitched perfectly.
Perfect.
And the post-wedding party that I do think went on about 10 minutes too long, doesn't matter. I still had so much fun watching these people embrace life and watching the other people, characters like Anne Hathaway's Kim, struggling to embrace life. I think it's all there to enjoy. And it's also one of the best recent movies, we touched on this during our review, at incorporating that handheld camera feeling without it seeming like a gimmick. You got to give a lot of credit to Demme and to his cinematographer, Declan Quinn. It's just incredibly well shot. And of course, the performances, we've both already praised Rosemary DeWitt, one of the best supporting performances of the year so far, and Bill Irwin, also one of the best supporting performances as Anne Hathaway's father. And then you have Anne Hathaway, got the Golden Globe nomination for Best Actress, surely going to make a lot of top 10 lists at the end of the year here, a lot of awards for her performance there. So really a film that, despite the fact that it's about people who are really hateful in some ways, it's a really lovely film.
That's a great pick. Well, from one dysfunctional family to another, my number six is A Christmas Tale. Not an easy film to digest at all. A dysfunctional family home for the holidays certainly has been done, but not with this kind of breadth and scope. It is a very, very free-form film, and it might lose you at points. It certainly lost me. I never knew where it was going from minute to minute, what relationship or burgeoning relationship we were going to examine for the next 10 minutes. The family dynamics are recognizable, but I don't think, I mean, we all know, you know, about the relationship to the bad uncle, you know, to the bad seed. But I don't think all of these relationships have ever been afforded this kind of minute dissection before. There are some very, very ugly moments in this film, but the film makes no attempt at all to balance them out. And at the end of the day, it seems to say, family. There you go.
Well, a lot like my previous pick, Rachel Getting Married.
Right, but if you were looking for a 20-minute celebration wedding dance, you are not going to
get
this in this French film.
You'll be searching for it.
Yes.
Well, of course, all those ugly moments can be compensated for by Catherine Deneuve's face.
Oh, yes.
That makes up for
still
so
a beauty,
much.
Still a beauty.
Absolutely. Well, let's get to my number six here, Maddie, and it is Happy Go Lucky, the new film from Mike Leigh, and it actually does remind me as well of Rachel Getting Married in the sense that that movie seems even though it was probably 100% scripted, it feels from moment to moment improvisational almost. You truly believe the characters are in that moment watching Rachel getting married. Here you have that same thing, except it truly was developed through this improvisational style that Mike Lee uses, where these characters are truly saying kind of whatever comes to their mind first, of course, and then it's cultivated over time and scripted out. It's just so natural. I had so much fun with these characters. We talked about Sally Hawkins, truly, for me, one of the best female performances of the year, one of the best performances of the year, period, as this happy-go-lucky main character who can't quite understand why everyone else isn't as plucky, for lack of a better term, as she is, and just the way she sees the world and the way she interacts with other characters. Eddie Marsan, one of the best supporting actor performances of the year. You know what? They're great together in those scenes, even though they're kind of hard to watch at times as her driving instructor, but just the way Lee explores the different teaching dynamics, the way you can teach people, the way you can learn, it's all there. And on top of it, it's funny. I just think it's a very hilarious film all at the same time dealing with some heavy stuff. So my number six.
And it works because there is a consequence to this character walking around with these rose-colored glasses all the time. You know, it's funny because have you ever been to a cat show?
No.
I always feel like a cat show judge when we're doing these things, and even more so this year, because what a cat show judge does is he calls his top 10 cats into the arena for his final judging. And then he goes around really dramatically to each cage and he pulls out the cat and he says, strong bone structure, nice top line, the Abyssinian, my 10th best cat.
Right.
And I think more so even than last year, you and I are pulling from the same top 20 cats.
We are.
Really, every film that you mentioned is probably in my 11 through 25.
Yes, and every film you mentioned may even be in my 1 through 5 and certainly could also make the 11 through 20. You're right. We were on similar ground a lot this year and are going to have some overlap, and that's fine. There were a lot of decent films, even though I think a lot of people would agree. You look at the top films from last year, maybe stronger at the top, but absolutely, I had 20 movies here. I had a hard time ranking, so that has to be a good thing.
All right. Well, up next, we welcome in the number one and number two ranked critics from my 2008 top film critics of the year, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and Scott Tobias of the AV Club. They will help finish out our top 10 films of 2008. Stay with us.
I never treated you so mean, like that's a reason to be proud. My love, I know it's been so long, but I thought that I'd just call around now. And with that smile that says, yeah, well, I knew you'd wait for me. I can hear you say, the day I fall down at your feet, go to hell, go to hell.
Hello, Adam and Maddie. It's Paul Moore from blog.spout.com. And this week in news, we have the review of Gran Torino. Karina Longworth liked the movie, surprisingly, mostly because of Clint Eastwood's balls-out performance on taking every racist comment and turning it up to 11. We have also decided to cast Governor Blagojevich's biopic. Check it out. It's called Blagojevich Biopic Casting Call. And also Lauren Wissett writes about an antidote to sexy Nazis. In this season, when we're watching Nazis in movies like The Reader, Defiance, Valkyrie, she harkens back to 1931, before Hitler, back to when Germany gave us the quote-unquote first sexy pro-dyke flick, Mädchen in Uniform. And you can watch it on YouTube. And in our weekly podcast, Film Couch, Kevin and I go into politics. We do this every once in a while, talking about filmmakers and how they deftly try to influence politics, and we found that Gus Van Sant seems to be stepping up as a major player in Washington, D.C. You can check it all out on blog.spout.com.
Hello, Adam and Maddie. This is Matt Singer from IFC. When you guys did the best movies of 2008 so far back in the summer, I chimed in with my favorite at the time, and my number one then is still my number one now, and that's Guy Madden's My Winnipeg. In the second half of the year, I've seen a lot of good movies, but none have amused me or touched me in the way that My Winnipeg did, and no filmmaker has impressed me more than Guy Madden did. And back in the summer, I wrote, and you guys read on the show, that My Winnipeg was like this perfect blend of all things that movies can do in one delightful package, and I still feel the same exact way. Thanks for another great year of Film Spotting Podcast, guys. Take it easy. Bye.
Hey, Film Spotting guys. It's Steve Procopi, a.k.a. Capone, from Ain't It Cool News. Just wanted to leave you, give you my choice for the best film of 2008, which to me was, without a doubt, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, a story of an entire life and a life lived about as full as any one life could be. It's a film that moved me emotionally, but it also made me really think about how life would be different living it the way this particular character does. And it's so rare today in a world where biography films are kind of coming back that we see a film about a person, albeit fictional, where we see the entire life story, I mean, birth to death. And I loved that, and I loved the way David Fincher made it look, and the acting is fantastic across the board. I didn't really see that I had any other choice in this matter. So that's my choice, Benjamin Button. I'll see you guys in a couple weeks, and thank you. Bye.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar. A couple voicemails there, Maddie. We always like to hear from some of our friends and colleagues this time of year. Steve Procopi here in Chicago saying his favorite film of the year is the same as Steven Soderbergh, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And then our buddy in New York, Matt Singer, agreeing that My Winnipeg, his pick from earlier in the year, my number 8 film of the year, is his number 1 film of the year. He's sticking with his midway point pick. And we do want to welcome in now a couple more special guests. Of course, our usual suspects here, the end of the year, Scott Tobias from the AV Club. Scott, great to have you here.
Thanks very much.
And Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. Nice to have you back.
Thanks.
All right. Well, we want to start. We just shared with our listeners in the previous segment our 10 through 6 picks of the year, our favorite films. We shared them with you off air. We want to get your picks here quickly before we dive into the top 5. So, Scott, why don't we start with you? What was your 10 through 6?
Okay. Number 10, Stuck. Number 9, The Dark Knight. Number 8, Wendy and Lucy. Number 7, Funny Games. And number 6, Man on Wire.
Some good picks there. What about you, Michael?
Number 10 for me, The Dark Knight. Number 9, Still Life from China. Number 8, Snow Angels. Number 7, Man on Wire. And number 6, Alexandra.
Alexandra, a film I have to admit, I saw in Toronto back a couple years ago, I think, and I did not get at all.
Really?
So maybe I need to revisit that film, knowing that you love it so much.
I saw it on the Chechen border.
So did you? that helps.
It had an extra resonance for me.
It's all about context. And of course, Still Life, one of those movies, Maddie, that we haven't caught up with yet, but I know is one we definitely need to check out. And of course, Man on Wire, another movie that is getting a lot of love. It may even get more love as we get through these top 5 picks here. So Maddie, why don't we go ahead and get into it here? Your number 5.
Well, my number 5 is In Bruges, the great dark comedy from director-playwright Martin McDonagh. I am guilty of talking this film up too much already, so I'll just say, out of all the directors on my list, I'm most excited to see what McDonagh has to bring to the screen next.
Yeah. It's a really interesting film. I agree. I had a lot of fun with it. I know it was one we all saw at Sundance, I think the three of us here anyway, right. And Maddie, maybe you as well. And you guys were a little more underwhelmed with it than we were. Is that right?
Very solid. Yeah. And I like McDonagh's writing a lot for the stage, but I think you're absolutely right about his directorial career. It's only going to get better.
It's only going to get better.
You know, it was a little arthritic in the, quote, action sequences, which the film had to deliver sort of more in the third act, where it's just clear, like David Mamet's early films, a little stiff, but beautiful writing.
Oh, exactly. The writing, the tightness of the script, every line means something. I think cinematically, he's learning. He's really going to grow. And I did love those last shots and what he was able to bring.
So. And Colin Farrell, a performance I know we were big fans of there.
Oh, so, Brendan Gleeson, great.
And great, too. As a duo, they're wonderful there. Scott, your number 5.
My number 5 is Paranoid Park. And to give you an idea of how weak 2008 has been, this is one of two movies in my top 5 that I saw over a year ago. And only one movie in my top five came out in the last 6 months.
Wow.
And with all due respect to Milk, which I don't think transcended the usual biopic problems, Paranoid Park is the Gus Van Sant movie of choice for 08 because he allows himself a much greater range of expression. My memories of the film are hazy since I haven't seen it for over a year. But what I do recall isn't the plot so much as the impressionistic ways that Van Sant and Christopher Doyle, the cinematographer, sort of lay out the parameters of a lonely adolescent's life.
Right. Yeah. It's a great pick.
I think it's supposed to leave you hazy because it's told basically through memory.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
And sort of an unreliable narrator.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think the Boston critics, I believe, were very sharp about awarding Van Sant best director for both Paranoid
films.
Park and Milk, because I would say certainly of Van Sant's more mainline Hollywood-style pictures, Milk is the first one that has any directorial personality in it at all, compared to Good Will Hunting.
Yes. Or Finding Forrester.
Finding Forrester, which I, you know, was in one eye, out the other.
Yeah, and the Boston critics actually did another solid by Paranoid Park that we will get to here in a moment, but first we want to get to your number five, Michael.
My number five is Hu Hsiao-hsien's The Flight of the Red Balloon. Hmm. Long time ago, we saw this first at Cannes, I think, a year and a half ago. And it's really, for me, a small but indelible masterpiece responding to another masterpiece, The Red Balloon from 1956. And it's a marvelous blend of improvisatory film technique and this really, really interesting performance from Julia Binoche. Completely not completely unsympathetic, but it's not a performance that looks for your sympathy at all in the story of a single mother just trying to deal with her life as a puppeteer and a single mother raising a boy. To me, that really felt like bittersweet magic. I really love it.
And it's really sort of, I think, a natural for Hu Hsiao-hsien. It doesn't seem that way because he's a Taiwanese filmmaker, but he's always been sort of a poet of urban alienation. And if you think about it, that really is what The Red Balloon is, in essence, is this relationship between a boy and this balloon, and he's a lonely kid.
Well, I'm the only guy in the room who has to confess I have not seen it yet. I've been meaning to all year. I know there are certain listeners who have been dying for me to see it and pushing for it, and I really did try to fit it in at the end of the year and couldn't make it, but it's one there at the top of the list I definitely need to see.
I have to say it's incredible in IMAX, too.
Is it? Yeah. I missed that,
The action sequences really pop in IMAX.
I bet they do. I'd like to see Juliette Binoche in IMAX, though. That would work just fine. Well, for me, my number five, Maddie, I think it was your number seven, definitely in your 10 through 6. You got to cue up the Bruce Springsteen. I know you love singing it. Go ahead.
Have you ever seen a one-trick pony?
My number five is The Wrestler from Darren Aronofsky, and we're going to review it here soon on the show, so I don't want to say too much about it, but I really love the stripped-down style that he uses here. Big contrast, of course, from The Fountain, but I just think it's really gracefully shot and never devolves into sentimentality like it could, and it doesn't ever patronize these characters or this world of these kind of has-been wrestlers either. And Mickey Rourke, I think, deservedly getting a lot of acclaim for this performance. He's about as understated and subtle as powerful as you can get. So for now, that's all I'm going to say about it, but it is my number five, The Wrestler.
I'm the one who was supposed to take care of everything. I'm the one who was supposed to make everything okay for everybody. But it just didn't work out like that. And I left. I left you. You never did anything wrong.
Well, my number four is the film Hunger, the first effort from British artist Steve McQueen, not that Steve McQueen. Mm-hmm. I absolutely adore the way he uses this film as his canvas, and he paints here with a myriad of techniques, including an uninterrupted 22-minute conversation between the actor Michael Fassbender as Bobby Sands and Liam Cunningham as Father Moran. This movie is not light reading, but I think it might be required reading. It tells the story of the Irish Republican hunger strike in agonizingly vivid detail. I think it's extraordinarily, extraordinarily moving.
Yeah, I was really curious about you finally getting to see that scene, that big 22-minute sequence between those actors, and what you would think of it. Obviously, it paid off.
Oh, it's an actor's dream, and the way they pull it off, it's masterful, just gorgeous.
Scott, what about you? You're number four.
My number four is Standard Operating Procedure. I know I'll get resistance from everyone in this room on this movie, but to me, Errol Morris's Abu Ghraib documentary is both a probing and disciplined investigation into the content of those infamous photos, and also a brilliant inquiry into the nature of photography itself, what photos can and cannot tell us, and how their meaning can be distorted by the very powerful.
Yeah, it's an interesting movie. We love Errol Morris here, and of course we did talk about this when we did our top five movies of the year so far, one of those films that was a little bit of a disappointment for me. I didn't get enough of that interesting inquiry into the nature of photography. I don't think there was the payoff there that I was
hoping
for.
It's all over the movie, yeah. Because I think he's kind of saying, you know, we're looking at the people who are posing, but we're not right. Next to these abused prisoners, but we're not actually looking at the content
right.
of
or
the
what's happening
themselves.
just outside the frame,
right. Which yeah. is my
and
problem.
I feel
with
like
it,
it's yeah. very disciplined in a way that I think the overpraised Taxi the Dark Side is not.
Well, I think they're both definitely worth seeing.
Yeah,
both
I may
docs.
Think of that one another look because it did strike me as elaborate and visually sort of excessive in a way that mm-hmm. smothered the subject rather than illuminated it. And I didn't feel that way with documentaries of his that had really a comparable amount of really bold aesthetic
right.
choices well, being made, such as you know, The Thin Blue Line,
well,
which I think
hard,
is his
it's a hard
best
film to sit through, but I think the oppressiveness of it is intended,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of captures in a very visceral way what it's like to be within this prison that's constantly being hit with mortars and just this psychological
yeah.
pressure, you know, this haunted place. I think he gets that in a very cinematic way.
It's definitely one I wouldn't dissuade anyone from seeing. I think it's worth their time, absolutely. Michael, what about you? Your number four.
My number four is Let the Right One In, the Swedish vampire film, which has come out just late this year. Just ironic that it came out around the same time as Twilight
yeah.
was hitting the teens right where they lived. And it was wonderful to be able to truly recommend another vampire
yes.
film in the, at the same time. And this thing, to me, it really feels like a complete reinvigoration of a genre that I frankly can take or leave,
right.
although some certain vampire pictures, especially not from the last 20 years or so. You know, I love, and certain versions of Dracula I adore, but this one felt like brand new material, and it's really a story kind of this really awkward adolescent friendship that happens to have this supernatural element. So,
yeah,
I really went for it.
Yeah, I we did too, actually. We both, when we reviewed it on the show, and I have to say it has one of those endings that I said at the time that I was really wrestling with, but wrestling in a good way because I didn't like the way it made me feel. It's one of the great endings of the year, without a doubt. I agree, it's a really good film.
Well, because it wasn't about the legend of the vampire.
No,
it wasn't
not
about
at
the
all.
Rules of being a vampire. There just happened to be a young boy who befriends a vampire,
yeah.
and he takes it on face value.
Definitely good stuff there. My number four, it's one we've heard about already, and it seems that, Maddie, we did have some overlap between your 10 through 6 and my top 5 here, as I knew this might happen. It is Paranoid Park, and this is a movie like A History of Violence, which at the time was Film Spotting's number one film of that year, 2005, and it was so divisive. There were so many listeners that wrote in and said, yeah, it's a masterpiece, and others who said, this is just terrible. What are you talking about? Paranoid Park got the same type of response, the Gus Van Sant film. It's a movie we really champion, yet a lot of people were mystified by. And I mentioned the Boston Film Critics Association. They rightly gave Christopher Doyle Best Cinematography. They awarded it Best Cinematography in their awards. Chicago Film Critics, my brethren here, unfortunately, I can't say they were as wise. They didn't even nominate it. It certainly got my vote. And I just think that the way Van Sant captures this disaffected youth, as you touched on, Scott, without ever glamorizing their lifestyle in kind of a Larry Clark sort of way or whatever, I just think is amazing. And the chronology of it, the discontinuity, I find just mesmerizing, the way it jumps around in time and plays with memory. And two, I just think it's that perfect kind of mixture of the experimental Van Sant with the long takes and the more conventional Van Sant and kind of a more conventional shooting style. It's kind of a go-between between Milk and Last Days, maybe, if you will. I just think it's a brilliant film, and it could be higher even, but for now, it's going to be my number four.
There's something that happened to me.
I thought so.
What I would do is I'd write a letter. Save it, send it, burn it. It just feels good to have it all out.
One day, halfway through math class, there was an announcement.
What we have is a possible murder situation. Take a look at these pictures and you're gonna understand why we're here.
I had tried to put this part out of my mind, but the picture brought it all back.
We're all in agreement. We all like Paranoid Park, though.
Such a good year for Van Sant, too.
Yeah.
Because he, you're absolutely right in point of putting Paranoid Park sort of on at one point on his kind of stylistic, mm-hmm. you know, timeline, right? And Milk is a little further to the right or to the center, but it doesn't lose what's good about. You can still tell a major director is behind the camera at its best, I'd say. And yeah, you just did not get that in some of the other Van Sant mainstream
sure.
stuff. And Paranoid Park, it's you know, there's a visual romanticism
mm-hmm.
there that, to me, it breaks right at the edge of excess. So
sure.
So the story still means something.
Yeah, I agree. Well, We want to close out this segment by actually getting to our poll questions real quick, and we'll jump into our top three here in the next segment. Of course, our question from last week, Maddie, we asked listeners, tying in with our top five, then we shared our top five supporting performances of the year, and we asked listeners, considering only the movies that have opened, so we wanted to obviously let everyone in here and be inclusive, which actress delivered the best supporting performance of 2008? Here were the choices based on our picks. Mila Kunis from Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Penelope Cruz from Vicky Cristina Barcelona, Rosemary DeWitt from Rachel Getting Married, Samantha Morton from Synecdoche, New York, or Viola Davis from Doubt. Of course, there's also the other option for those who didn't want to pick one of those five. Maddie, how did it come out?
Well, most of our listeners, of course, agreed with me. Penelope Cruz from Vicky Cristina Barcelona coming in at number one at 32%. Mila Kunis, second place, 29%. Rosemary DeWitt, 15%. More people need to see that film.
Yes. Mm.
Other coming in at 12%. Samantha Morton from Synecdoche, New York, 8%. More people need to see that film. And this film just opened, so people haven't been able to enjoy Viola Davis, In Doubt, at 4%.
Yeah, you did pick Penelope Cruz. I went with Rosemary DeWitt and was hoping she'd finish a little higher, but I do think more people have probably seen Mila Kunis in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, so that helps. What about you guys real quick? Scott, where would you have gone in that poll question?
In that poll, I would have gone with Rosemary DeWitt as well. Followed by Viola Davis, I think, in the, you know, it's really just one scene.
It is.
But she's extraordinary.
She knocks it out of the park. She does.
And then Other would be my third choice.
Okay. What about you, Michael?
Yeah, I'd have to go with Rosemary DeWitt as well. That's the toughest role in Rachel Getting Married, where the sympathies are the most conflicted. And I think that actress is really sharp about making her not sort of the standard issue bitch, you know, which in a way she's written as.
Yep.
So it's a performance that sort of improves the writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's relatively new to film. She's on Mad Men, the TV show. I think she's got a big career ahead of her.
Definitely.
All right, well, time for one more last quick break. Then we'll be back to reveal our top three films of 2008. Mr. Shyamalan, you can probably stop holding your breath now.
Well, the day comes down, lengthy shadows on unfamiliar towns, and I drove 300 miles from the place I call home, and I tip my hat to the angel of the north.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD. A little better than last week, Maddie, even though some of these films may be a little bit disappointing. We start with the new Coen Brothers entry, Burn After Reading. That movie is out now. One we were not huge fans of, but definitely worth checking
out.
But,
you know, a lot of people did write in this film's defense. They said, hey, you know what? The first time I saw Big Lebowski, I wasn't wowed by it either, and I'm guilty of that. So this is a film I am going to check out on DVD.
It might grow with other viewings in our estimation. We will have to see. Also out, Hamlet 2. This was a comedy from the summer we both did like. I believe we did our top five screen teachers tying in with it and interviewed Steve Coogan. He didn't make my cut. He's not going to make my best performances of the year, but definitely up there for best male comedic performances of the year. He's great in it.
Oh, the last 15 minutes, the actual production itself is glorious.
The movie that Maddie was dying to see
number
this past
one,
summer.
Number one on my Netflix queue.
And yet we never did discuss it. The House Bunny with Anna Faris is out now. It has deleted scenes, Maddie, and 12 featurettes.
Oh, wow. I can't get enough.
I don't know what those possibly could be. Also, Traitor. This is the Don Cheadle movie, I think, that just flew under the radar. We don't know anything about it other than Don Cheadle. Maybe Guy Pearce, I want to say, is in it as well. Death Race is out. That has an audio commentary with director Paul W.S.
Oh, W.S.
Don't call me
for a second.
Paul Thomas Anderson. And then The Women, a movie that we got chided for a little bit for not giving any love to from some of our female listeners. It's out now. Now we have no excuse. We got to check it out.
All right. Well, it's time now for donations. And we want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. And I want to thank everyone who donated over the course of the past year. We truly are humbled by each and every donation we receive in more ways than one. Our listeners, you the listeners, make this show. And you guys have made it an amazing year for Film Spotting. And hopefully we're going to have some really exciting things to announce next year and continue on the goodwill. I can't give you much, but I can give you my heartfelt thanks. So thank you, thank you, thank you to a Gold Club donor, Alexander from beautiful Miami Beach, Florida.
That's Alexander the Burn Redeemer, I believe his nickname is, and he is a longtime listener and big-time supporter of the show. Thank you so much, Alexander.
Also want to thank Silver Club donor Taylor from Burbank, California. Burbank, California, I love that town. I've had my heart broken several times in that city. If you ever get a chance, do stay at the Safari Inn. It is a total retro 1960s Hollywood kitsch fest.
Nice.
I do love staying there. And we also want to say domo arigato to Brian from Suginami-ku, which I believe just stands for Suginami City in Tokyo,
near Chino.
Japan. Exactly, in near Chino. That's the second donation we've gotten in the past 2 weeks from the Isle of Nippon.
Yes.
Also want to thank Tony from Kapa Kapa, Auckland, New Zealand, a town of 3,000 people north of Auckland.
And they all listen to Film
Spotting. I think so. Thank you so much, Tony. Rob, who is manning the guns of Brixton in London. Thanks so much, Rob. Stephen in Arlington, Virginia. Adam, have you ever been to the cemetery in Arlington?
I have not. I would like to go.
It is absolutely serene, but if you ever get a chance, of course, if you're a veteran of the United States military, you can be buried in Arlington
yes.
with full honors. I've seen a couple of those funerals. They are beautiful.
Really?
And the precision is something to be marveled at. Also want to thank Jeff from right here in Chicago, a Massacre Theater winner. What is this trend?
I don't know. They win a prize from us. They pay us back. That's how generous our listeners are.
The most selfless listeners in the world. Also want to thank Mark from Ottawa, Canada, in Ontario. Of course, we sent you up there on a peacekeeping mission this year. Also want to thank Aaron from New York. I believe he's up there in West Harlem in Hamilton Heights area. Thanks, Aaron. Want to thank Richard.
Are you stalking Aaron, Maddie?
Yes, exactly. I have GPS on him right now. Richard from West Hartford, Connecticut. Of course, Hartford, once home to my beloved Hartford Whale.
Yes,
I
they
bled
are gone.
Green for several years, now gone. Also want to thank Paul from Windsor, Ontario. Windsor, Ontario, of course, where every 19-year-old from Detroit goes when they hit 19.
That is true.
Mark from, here we go. Mark from Moorooptna, Victoria, Australia, a town of 7,000 people north of Film Spotting's sister city of Melbourne.
That's it.
Also want to thank Zach from Spokane, Washington, which I believe is absolutely gorgeous. It's right across from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
I do so look forward to your geography lessons every week,
Maddie. Each and every week. Remember that for every $10 you donate, your name is entered into the Film Spotting hat, and then we pick a name at random, and the winner gets to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours, and it's also entered to win free Film Spotting merchandise.
That's true.
And a copy of Maddie Robinson Sings Lloyd Webber just in time for the holidays. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab. It's right there. It's right there. You can't miss it at the top of the page.
And our last listener's choice winner was Lance in Arlington, home of the Texas Rangers. And we are going to review his pick, Les Samurai, the Jean-Pierre Melville film, on our next edition of After Hours. We're hoping it's going to come before the first of the year. Maddie, are we going to deliver on that promise? Are we going to be able to pull it off?
I will guarantee you right now. I guarantee you on my salary, we will put that out.
You heard it here.
And I just can't wait to see you on Sunday. Far from the traffic and the smoke and the noise. Before this evening I'll play back every message that you sent.
Hi, this is Danny Boyle, director of Sunshine and Trainspotting, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Hi, Film Spotting. This is David Chen from the Slash Filmcast, and my number one movie of the year is Danny Boyle's Slumdog Millionaire. It's been a tremendous year for movies, but when you look at critically acclaimed films like Doubt, The Wrestler, and The Dark Knight, you quickly realize that while they're all excellent movies, they all prominently feature brooding leads, depressing themes, and or endings that make you question the state of humanity in the world. Slumdog Millionaire dares you to believe that in a world ravaged by poverty and violence, the power of love can still hold sway. And cinematically, it proves that you can take tired cliches such as love at first sight and rags to riches and make them fresh and thrilling again. Thank you guys for running the best movie podcast on the internet.
Hi, this is Tasula from the Cinebanter podcast. And topping my list for 2008 is Courtney Hunt's debut film, Frozen River. The performances by Melissa Leo and Misty Upham are award-worthy, and the overall story of a working mother caught up in the world of illegal alien smuggling had me gripping my popcorn throughout. This is one of those rare gems where the writing, the directing, and the acting all meld together so perfectly you forget you're watching fiction.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. We are joined by our special guest, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and Scott Tobias from the AV Club. And we're about to count down our final three movies, our top three movies of 2008. You just heard a couple picks there from some fellow podcasters and critics. Tasula, her favorite film of the year, Frozen River. Melissa Leo getting a lot of buzz for her performance there in that movie. And then Dave Chen, a big fan, as many film critics groups are, of Slumdog Millionaire, the Danny Boyle film. That was his number one pick of the year. But we're going to reveal our final three here. Maddie, why don't you kick us off with your number three?
Well, my number three, actually along the same lines, I guess, of Slumdog Millionaire, is Chop Shop from director Ramin Barani. The standout performance by Alejandro Polanco as this cagey street kid who lives among the chop shops and junkyards in the Iron Triangle in Queens near Shea Stadium. I just think it's a wonderful film. I'd love to see more American films done in this very minimalist style. And I was thinking about this today. I think it's an urban compliment to the likewise minimalist films of Kelly Reichardt, such as Old Joy and Wendy and Lucy. I love this film.
You know, it also reminded me a little bit of Ballast. Different in kind of the way it's shot, but dealing with those characters on the fringe. I actually like Ballast a little more, but both of those films stood out for me kind of in that way this year. I think it's a great pick. I know it was on your list earlier in the year, actually. Your number
Number four and number three.
It was
still
up there.
Yeah.
And what you're saying about just sort of telling stories that we don't hear and see every month of the year on screen. You know, it's a simple thing, but it's a very elusive thing. And as different as they are stylistically, Chop Shop, Ballast, and something like Frozen River all do that. They take you to a corner of this country and sort of on a socioeconomic level we don't deal with very often unless we're totally romanticizing the hell out of poverty, like Slumdog Millionaire does, as much as I admire some of that film. But, you know, that's the great virtue of Chop Shop.
I think it does. It also falls outside of that typical indie template of the really earnest Sundance favorite. It feels international.
It does.
In a way that American independent films rarely do.
Definitely. Good point there. What about your number three, Scott?
My number three is 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. And this won the Palme d'Or way back in May of 2007. And it's as tense and gripping as any thriller that's come along since. And, you know, it's about, of course, the quest of two women to procure an illegal black market abortion in communist Romania. But it isn't so much about the issue itself, but about a period where people lived in fear and paranoia, and the rights were restricted. And this lead performance by Anna Maria Marinka as the woman who helps her roommate get this abortion is stunning. It is, to me, the performance of the year.
Yeah, it really is good. And what's interesting, of course, is I recall, Michael, I believe last year you sat here and named this as your number two or three film of the year.
It was up there.
It is one of those movies that fell just in that, you know, we reviewed it here after the first of the year, but it was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film last year. I don't know, it missed out.
That was a big controversy.
You're right. Because they excluded it.
It's very confusing because the film really only got released last year for one week in Los Angeles.
Yep. Wow. The qualifying week.
I figure, you know, I usually go by New York.
Yeah. Well, I've got a big note here on my list of honorable mentions that says no 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, where I'm just reminding myself that it very easily could have been on this list. It should have been on my list probably last year, and yet it's ended up in this sort of purgatory, this no man's land.
It's great, though.
It really is. It's a good pick. Michael?
My number three would be A Christmas Tale by Arnaud Desplechin. That's an ensemble film that really, for me, has the amplitude of a good novel. And like a lot of Desplechin's ensemble work, I'm thinking of it, My Sex Life and Kings and Queen, they go on for much longer than any of the typical American equivalent would go. His films tend to run 2.5, even 3 hours, and yet you do not feel at all itchy or restless. You just feel like you're getting to know on their own time a host of eccentric characters, and in this case, you're dealing with this family reuniting at Christmas, kind of a typical setup. And I don't know, I really thought this was the most unpredictable tonal achievement of the year, where you know it's truly funny at points and truly, truly bittersweet and kind of heartbreaking at others. And, you know, in the middle of it, you have a very kind of zen-like performance from Catherine Deneuve, who is playing an unsympathetic role in a way that, you know, doesn't apologize for it a second. I really love this film. It paid off beautifully a second time.
Yeah, it's an interesting film, and it is one, you're right, tonally you could never quite get a grip on it. And that's what makes it interesting. It's totally unpredictable.
And that's what he's all about. His films have tremendous energy. He feels like a French New Wave filmmaker to me.
He does.
And this one, it's really, I think, a nice corrective to the holiday movie. It's, these are really, every single person in this movie is a very prickly, complex character. And it's all of their problems are not going to be magically resolved in time for Christmas dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're talking about Four Christmases now, right?
Or nothing like the holidays.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, my number three, Maddie, you stole my thunder a little bit. It is Hunger, the Steve McQueen film. This is a movie that just has not been seen enough, I think. I was really hoping that some of the film critics groups would recognize it, and it isn't getting a lot of attention. It's played in Toronto. It played here in Chicago, and I know it opened for just a week in L.A. Yeah, to get eligible for the Oscars or whatever, but it doesn't meet the criterion I mentioned earlier in the show of dying to see it again. I can't say I'm really eager to go back into that prison with Bobby Sands. It's pretty brutal to watch, and yet it is, Maddie, as you said, absolutely fantastic to look at. And Steve McQueen, as an artist, you can tell that he is this visual mm-hmm. artist, despite being a first-time filmmaker. It's got just such a gorgeous look to it, and every frame of the movie could be a frame. You just see his palette, and you could take it out and put it on the wall. It's pretty amazing.
Well, there's that opening moment where the guard comes out to have a cigarette,
yeah.
and it's pretty much just white against a white wall, and you're
sure.
thinking, I'm in very good hands now.
Definitely, and you're right about the amazing 20-plus minute take that is at its core, the performance by Michael Fassbender. Actually, why don't we go ahead and hear a clip from that great scene in Hunger.
But having a respect for my life, a desire for freedom, an unyielding love for that belief, means I can see past any doubts I may have. Putting my life on the line is not just the only thing I can do, Dawn. It's the right thing.
This is why you called me here. You need a sounding board. Not 100% sure of yourself. Been doubting yourself, maybe.
Aye. Well, only a human.
Both great performances and a really interesting film. What did you guys think of Hunger, Michael?
I didn't see it.
Mm. Yeah, me neither. It's one of those things I'm considering it 2009.
No, are you?
I have to do the same because it's just one of those things that even though it played the Chicago Film Festival
sure.
and people really did respond to it strongly. It's just something that's I'm gonna have to be on the backside.
You're just proving my point that it's criminally underseen, and hopefully more people will try to seek it out as it comes out here. So, Maddie, your number two.
Well, my number two is Trouble the Water, the Katrina documentary from Carl Lesson and Tina Deal. I have to put it up here because I don't think I've ever reacted as viscerally to a movie as I did to the footage captured by Kimberly Roberts and her family as the levees break and the waters rise around them in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans. I mean, it really is life and death. And at the end, it just left me completely A, exhilarated, and B, absolutely bereft and angry. So I have to award a film that is able to evoke that in me.
Sure, absolutely. Scott, what about you?
My number two is Wall-E, and the first 30 minutes, really, of this movie are is really as magical a stretch of cinema as I experienced this year. And, where other animated films being made these days are all about sort of brightly colored, wisecracking animals, Pixar had the courage to zag by embracing silence and giving us this dusty, mm-hmm. desolate world of our own creation.
Mm-hmm.
And Wall-E, I think, is also proof that a strong personal vision can survive the elephantine production and highest expectations of blockbuster entertainment.
Yeah, definitely. Wally, we'll get to it here in a minute. I'm sure it's going to come up again, and it's definitely going to come up on my big regrets that somehow, I'll say, it was left off my list. What about you, Michael?
My number two was the film that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes this last year, The Class.
I was afraid you were going to go here.
No, I
want to see it.
I know. No, it hasn't. And it's called The Class. It's Laurent Conté. It's beautiful. Probably, for me, one of the best films ever about teachers and students. It's not going to open in Chicago or the rest of the U.S. until February or March, and I think they're hoping for a Best Foreign Language Oscar mm-hmm. Nomination, certainly. But this film really, really sent me out on that kind of cloud that you're describing, Maddie, with Trouble the Water, where you feel a sense of exhilaration and just the people you've gotten to know on the mm-hmm. screen. And even though this is not a documentary, it's shot very documentary style, and it's based on a French middle school teacher's book about 1 year in the life, right? And he plays a version of himself on screen. Marvelous, unaffected performance, incredible kids, and I just really I really can't wait to see it again.
One we will definitely talk about here when it opens in Chicago. My number two, you said it, Michael, it's been a really good year for Gus Van Sant. I easily could have exchanged these two picks, but I have Milk in here at the number two slot, and I've been a little disappointed, Maddie, that a number of listeners have written in agreeing with you and agreeing with Scott Tobias that, you know, it's a good movie, but it's disappointingly conventional, at least for Van Sant. I have to say maybe it's only because it's Van Sant it's disappointingly conventional, and I can't fault Van Sant for wanting to make a film that would appeal, making this film so that it will appeal to a mass audience. He does clearly have an agenda here, but I think that I agree with you, Michael, that it would be a markedly different film, certainly visually, if made by someone else. I think that his hands are all over this movie.
Well, yeah, I'd like to hear a little more from Scott just about why. Do you think it was more like calculation to send this material into more of a mainstream success mode, or what?
Well, I think really it just boils down to, I have kind of a biopic allergy, and I think that the movie doesn't get over the sort of lumpy nature of a biopic where it's, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. I think that there are characters who appear in the movie that, to me, leave without making that large of an impression.
You're right. That definitely happens. I agree with some of the supporting characters, and I think I expressed that during our review, that was really the only real flaw I had with this movie, because I do completely disagree with you in terms of what he captures here and what the screenwriter Dustin Lance Black captures. I just think that the moments they capture between the characters are not typical biopic moments. They don't just push the story forward. I think they actually kind of show the evolution of this man, this politician, and the movement. Somehow they capture all that and make it feel like it's truly unfolding in front of our eyes. Nothing was kind of preordained the way it does in a usual biopic.
I would say that I think most of what really works about that film for me is not the writing. It's everything that's being done with it. And I think there's other success stories you can point to this year. Rachel Getting Married and The Wrestler would come to mind, where you have directors and actors loosening up material and playing away from the cliche and the and the conventional structure of the screenplay and a lot of the corn, really, you know, in the case of The Wrestler. I mean, I would not want to see a Playhouse 90 type approach to The Wrestler or Rachel Getting Married.
Sure.
And the fact that these experiences kind of live and breathe on their own, it's really more a testament to what's being done with writing that's okay.
Okay, well, I think the writing's better, but I'm definitely with you on giving a lot of praise to Van Sant for what he did with it and making Milk. I think one of the better films of the year, obviously. So here we are, though. We are at the grand moment. We're going to get the number one films of the year. If this was American Idol or something, we'd have to cut to commercial, but we're just going to get right to it. Maddie, what's your number one?
Well, why don't we cut to a clip? Well, that was the Little Tramp from WALL-E. Yes, I don't like the final third of this film as much as I do the first. I think the first 20 minutes, as you said, are absolutely enchanting. But there's just a sense of timelessness to this film. And when compiling my list, basically what I wanted to be able to do was 10 years from now to look back. And I don't think I'll be ashamed calling this film a masterpiece. I really did love this film.
All right. Well, obviously, there's some agreement here at this table. Scott, what about you? Your number one.
My number one is Rachel Getting Married. And to me, you know, when independent movies are described as quote-unquote humane, I tend to brace myself for an earnest, well-meaning John Salesy snooze.
What's wrong with that? I like John Salesy movies.
I'm dropping bombs here.
I value a good nap.
But in Jonathan Demme's hands, humane means warm, it means vibrant, it means compassionate and full of life. And though it's an absolutely wrenching story of a family in tatters, Rachel Getting Married is also a party of many different moods, often joyful, and that gives the film a bittersweet quality that's hugely affecting. For me, the cutting of the cake in particular may be my single favorite image in a movie all year.
Yeah, it really is a wonderful film. Michael, let's get to your number one.
My number one is WALL-E as well.
Wow.
I think if you look at a film that I like better than you guys, I think last year, Ratatouille. If you look at Ratatouille, last summer, and this, that is a 1-2 combination that I don't think you can equate with anything else in modern Hollywood. I think both those films are really amazing. They're completely non-formulaic. A couple of problems I had with WALL-E the first time, even though I loved it, sort of went away the second time. This idea of moving from the for lack of a better term, the critter world to the human world, mm-hmm. which is kind of the rap against Ratatouille, right? That it starts out as the story of these rats, the gourmand and everything, and then you sort of shift into the human world, mm-hmm. and maybe that's a little disappointing or more familiar. And I'll tell you, the second time through with Wally, it's like all my expectations or preconceptions were really kind of, you know, away. And by the end, for my money, it's the film that hits the mood of this country inadvertently right on the money. You know, dire situation, but you have this sort of can-do optimist in the middle of it. And I'm not talking about Obama now. I mean, you know, I'm talking about, you know, this goggle-eyed robot. And I think this film, first half hour, yes, it's the best thing I've seen all year.
Right.
And really, the rest of it works better than I even realized the first time.
Yeah, and I was talking again with our buddy Sam Smith. I mentioned a couple segments ago, and he was really laying it on me when I was telling him that it wasn't in my top 10 because he adored it. And he said that even that last third or whatever, even if it's not as good as the amazing first part, it's still better than you think it is if you go back and watch it again. And I definitely want to go back and check it out and see how wrong I am for not having it on this list.
2009, Film Spotting with your hosts, Michael Phillips and Matt Robinson.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, hey, obviously here, you guys all know what you're talking about. You all had it in your top five and your top two, actually, and I don't even have it in my top 10.
If you say American Teen right now as your number one, you are off the show.
Hannah
I think
Bailey.
It's in the contract.
Hannah Bailey, she's pretty amazing, Maddie, but no, it is not that documentary, and it's actually another documentary. I don't think that it's just the best documentary of the year, as many people are saying, but at least until tomorrow when I change my mind again, I think it's the best film of the year. Why don't we hear a scene from it?
When he got to the building, we asked him to get off the high wire, but instead he turned around and ran back out into the middle. Everybody was spellbound in the watching of it. When we observed to the fact that he wasn't about to come in because he seemed to be enjoying it so much, we mentioned the fact to his associate that if he did not come in, we would have a helicopter pluck him up off of the wire. At which time his associate spoke to him in French, being that he's a Frenchman.
Philippe!
That is a scene from Man on Wire. You guys all had it in your top 10. I obviously have it even higher. It is my number one film. I'd also argue that James Marsh is also maybe the best director of the year for what he's able to do with that material and taking this solitary event that is amazing. But I'll admit that when I heard about this movie at Sundance, I wasn't dying to see it. I thought, okay, great. So this guy pulled off this amazing feat. What are you going to do with the other 95 minutes? And yet through the recreations and through the footage he has and with all the photos, he's able to turn it into not only a compelling documentary, but a compelling heist movie. This really is a suspense thriller, and the way they pull off, instead of being a heist, it's something more transcendent than that. And it truly is in those moments when we see Philippe Petit on the wire, even in photographs, the most moving for me kind of transcendent film of the year. And I say to anyone that wonders, wait a second, why is this movie getting so much love? Well, you have to sit through it and get to those closing scenes and the build up to it. And I think it absolutely pays off. It's my number one.
Yeah, it's a great film. It's also the most affecting period piece I can remember seeing this year, where you just feel, you know, I mean, there's not one word, of course, spoken about what happened to the Twin Towers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't need that. God knows it would add a political layer that the film couldn't support. But every once in a while you get a filmmaker on the level of an Errol Morris, mm-hmm. when he came along, you know, and to make you realize that the documentary form really can accommodate an artist.
You're right, absolutely. In terms of the score, too, is something I think that adds to that period sense. There is a nostalgia about the film, the way it uses it, and you're a better score guy than me. I can't remember the name of the piece that it incorporates that's not original. It's something that's been used in other films.
Oh, it's
and,
the Satie.
Yeah.
It's from The Cook, the Thief, His Wife,
well,
and
no,
the Lovers, isn't it?
Well, that's also in it. Right. There's Peter Greenaway music, but there's also, I believe it's that theme you hear at the end of My Dinner with Andre.
Yeah.
And it's sort of become my favorite melancholy New York theme based
that's
on
it.
My Dinner with Andre and how they
and
use
now
it
you
in
see
Man
it
on
here.
Wire.
Yeah, in Man on Wire. It's really great. So it is my number one film of the year. Guys, quickly here as we close, why don't we get to some honorable mentions, the movies that just missed the cut that you feel awful about. Scott?
Just missing the cut for me, Synecdoche, New York, Pineapple Express, The Strangers, Ballast, and The Edge of Heaven.
Very good. Michael?
I'm gonna make up for Scott's five with 12.
Please do.
Ballast, Happy-Go-Lucky, Iron Man, Milk, Mama's Man, My Winnipeg, Rachel Getting Married, Reprise, Synecdoche, New York, Trouble the Water, Chop Shop, and I think I would probably also throw in Frownland. Did anybody see
no.
that? Well, check it out, guys. See it.
Well, all good stuff. Obviously, a lot of overlap in our lists, and that, of course, means that the four of us must be right about something. That must mean what it is. For me, I got to mention, Maddie, real quick, I'll say my picks here. WALL-E is number 11, the one that I really probably should have had in the top 10 somewhere.
It is now, yeah.
It is now, absolutely, after I've been shamed. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Revolutionary Road, Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired, and I will throw Funny Games in there as well. Let the Right One In, also just outside that top 15, a movie I really did enjoy. Maddie?
Well, I'm going to go ahead, if we can do this.
Sure.
I'm going to post my top 25 on the website at filmspotting.net.
Give them something to go to the website for, right?
All right. Well, those are our top 10 films of 2008. Please send your top 10 or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Out new in wide release this weekend, The Tale of Despero, Yes Man and 7 Pounds, Doubt and Gran Torino are expanding to a few more screens. Maddie and I are going to try to take a little break from the show here to close out the year, but that doesn't mean there won't be new film spotting programming. We're going to have reviews of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, of Valkyrie, The Reader, can't get enough of Nazis apparently, Revolutionary Road, and The Wrestler. Check the film spotting calendar page for our show schedule. You can do that at filmspotting.net/calendar.
Thanks, as always, to Candace for her invaluable assistance in putting the show together, and to all our listener volunteers in the Film Spotting message boards. Special thanks to Tori Malatia and Steve Edwards at Chicago Public Radio, along with Golden Joe Dassault for his sometimes amazing production help. Without Joe, there would be no Film Spotting. And to David Ford for this week's music. Learn more at davidford.com. M-U.
That's for music, Maddie. I think it's for music. Of course, we also want to give a big thank you to our special guest, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. Michael, where can our listeners find you on the web as they should be reading you?
On the web, they can navigate the website, which has its issues, chicagotribune.com/talkingpictures, and you can't find any reviews there at all. We're working on it.
All right.
Okay.
What about you, Scott? Where can we find you on the web from the AV Club, of course?
AVClub.com.
All right. Well, absolutely, both of them are required reading every week. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays, everybody.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Keep up on all the Oscar buzz, movie lists, and must-see movie reviews on blog.spout.com. Then discover more about the movies and join the conversation yourself at spout.com.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. This week on the show, we'll round out the year in film by rounding up some of Film Spotting's usual suspects.
Could you hit that anymore, Maddie?
Oh, I thought it was cute. All right, we'll do it again.
Let's do it one more time.
Kempinar didn't like that take.
By rounding up?
By rounding up.
How clever am I?
You asked me to be clever. When it's not clever, you get pissed. Can you just spruce that up?
Can you spruce it up? Come on.
That's not clever.
You're Mr. Spruce. Okay, here we go.